Sheesh, hawa, tos knusum, salamat, thank you, and welcome to Juno Afternoon. I'm Boston Christopher. Today, Dr. Hune Lance Twitchell, professor of Alaska Native Languages, on a new MA degree in teaching Indigenous languages out at the university. Plus, Perseverance Theater's newest production, Pueblo Revolt, opens next Friday, February 27th. We chat with the creative team. Those conversations are coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon from your community-supported public media station, KTOO. Or you can catch us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages.
Hansen Gress, Ka eat with the Shu Yi, we Kashuk a eat in. Jin Katka K Jin Tauk Anakaya ha anikak Gunish Cheesh.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Tongass Federal Credit Union, a member-owned financial cooperative offering checking and savings accounts, loans, and digital financial services. In Juno at 8585 Old Dairy Road in the K Plaza and at tongassfcu.com, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Kushtuk-U Bill Fawcett, and the word this week is dleit.
Tleit.
That means snow. And here's a sentence. It's really snowing. Let's hear it again.
Tleit.
Snow. Gunish Cheesh to Hune Lance Twitchell, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Kushtuk O Ish Bill Fawcett was Slukach Adi and the child of a Southern Toshone man who passed away before Bill was born. His mother later married Tsihua Bill Fawcett, who helped raise Bill. He lived on Akkwan Ani and enjoyed working with advanced language learners, helping them answer difficult questions about the language.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
Song called Perfect Combo from Yatsine's new album called Stand on My Shoulders, collaboration with Dreamcast Mo. It's called Perfect Combo. You are listening to community supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Ok Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher, and I love that song because it's a perfect combo. Language, learning, perfect combination. The University of Alaska Southeast has been growing its revitalization of Alaska Native languages through a variety of programs. There are degrees in Indigenous Studies, Alaska Native Language and Studies, and minors and certificates in Northwest Coast Arts, Indigenous Language Speaking, and Indigenous Language Teaching, and oh, so much more. And although he is currently on sabbatical for this academic year, I'm pleased to welcome into the studio Professor of Alaska Native Languages, Dr. Hune Lance Twitchell, who has some exciting updates and projects to share with us. I sort of teased it in the intro, sort of gave away the lead, the log line. But Gunith Cheesh, Ha'igudi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you back in the studio. How are you? Wasiyati.
Ya
Kaja dusa adat ye has chine, kayende, dat has nakaya yaha yukatunki. I'm good. I'm feeling a lot of gratitude today to everyone who's ever taught me stuff and anyone who has ever stood up for indigenous languages. I spent a little bit of time about a week ago, I guess, in Washington, D.C. with folks from a group called Ani Kobijigeng, which is the National Native American Language Resource Center. And so it's folks who run probably two of the most successful Native American language schools, so Navajo in Ahopunaleo in Hawaii, and Wadokadaging in Wisconsin, which is an Ojibwe language school. So get a lot of inspiration from those folks, and I see so much potential for what can happen here in Alaska. But we gotta make moves. And so it is time to make big moves and not small moves. And I'm excited to make those moves.
Yeah, and so this big news that is happening, you are creating, and I believe it begins this fall, after, because there's a BA in Indigenous Studies, there's a BLA in Alaska Native Language, but now you're going to have a Master of Arts in teaching Indigenous languages, and that's going to begin this fall.
Yeah. We've been working on this for several years, and it goes back to my colleague Ida Heather Burge and I collaborating to create a certificate in teaching Indigenous languages. And as we look at how our language is taught in Alaska, who teaches them, what are their qualifications, what are they permitted to do in the current school systems? And what they're permitted to do is just not enough. And so we figure there's not equal pay, there's not equal control of curriculum. So then we had a plan of developing a Master of Arts in teaching Indigenous languages. And the goal here is that once you get this degree, you are a fully licensed and certified teacher that has the same qualifications as any teacher in Alaska. And this is, it's been way too long. We've been waiting way too long for something like this. But I think when it comes to doing Indigenous language work, there can be no waiting. You have to strategize the next thing, and you have to carve out your space for it. So this degree has to go before the Board of Regents. And so we're very hopeful that they will see the value in it. They'll see the need. They'll see the demand. I think it's maybe one of two programs that are like it, perhaps in all of North America.
Wow. Well, and it comes from sort of this outgrowth of the classes. You're teaching classes in all three of the sort of Southeast Indigenous languages. And a few years ago, those were made available to the community for no charge. You could audit the class, basically. You don't have to take it for credit and for no charge, so you can learn the language. And I know we've had you on the air before talking about that in terms of, you know, you shouldn't have to pay to learn your language. And I want to go back to, like, when did that begin? Like, when did teaching the language out at the university begin?
Well, I think it goes back to Walter Soboloff, Khichne, Nora Marks Dauenhauer, Kalkatlat, Florence Shakley. There have been several others who have started teaching this language. And so this is nothing new for us. This goes back to 1970s, 1980s, when a lot of work started happening in our region with our three languages, with Tlingit and with Hatkil and with Tsimalagech. And one of the things that we saw was an interest in preserving the language. And despite all of the wonderful work that happened, we saw all three languages go through a massive decline to the point where there were some people predicting that they would be gone by now. Like if you go back and read scholarship that people are producing in the 2000s, like Dr. Michael Krauss, you would see that they are fully predicting that these languages would be gone. And so I remember I ran into Dennis Demert, who's one of my inspirations and a teacher of mine. And I saw him in Sitka, and I went up, shook his hand, and he laughed, and he said, well, I wish some of those guys were alive to see us now, to see what we're doing. But the thing is, like, I think there's not – I want it to be a higher level of near panic
in terms of how we feel about our languages, and then the appropriate response in terms of what it's really going to take to say, okay, 10 speakers is not enough, 20 speakers is not enough. If there's 30,000 Tlingit people, there should be at least 15,000 speakers of Tlingit. Mm. But to be able to get to that is going to take some monumental shifts in the way that we do things, which is really hard today, because one of the things that a colonial government likes to do is pretend that there's no time, there's no money, everything's already spoken for. And so you end up with these sort of like, that sounds wonderful, but we just can't sort of modes of looking at the issue. But I think those are just sort of baked into the system. And if you can adjust the system to be something other than what it is, which is usually a language killing machine, like all of these languages were healthy and fine. There's well over 500 languages on the North American continent. And then you have our Pacific Island languages and many, many others. But now all of them are either endangered or severely endangered or asleep with nobody currently speaking them. And so for me, I would love for our political leadership, for our community leadership to say, not on my watch. Like while I'm here, while I'm alive, I will do everything I can to make sure that the wrongs that have happened to Indigenous peoples and their languages are made right by the same amount of effort, the same amount of money, maybe even sort of saying, well, you know, take into account how much money is worth these days. But these were federal employees. These were people affiliated with churches and with governments who tried to completely destroy these languages. So what I'm hoping to see is this massive increase of collaboration with communities, with partners, with state and federal governments, and with churches to say, like, let's put our minds together and see what kind of wonderful things we can do.
Mm. Well, and the it all starts with education, I feel like, the beginning of that, the sort of the, you know, we're all, everyone, it's, and it seems like the languages have been growing. You know, I know over the pandemic, the, you know, Alfie Price started the Somaliac Learners Group on Zoom, and people started getting to, and that's still going, right? And they still do that work. And the languages are more, I think people are more aware of the language. It's not exactly where maybe we'd want it to be, obviously, you know. I do think of places I visit where, you know, in Southern California or in other parts of, like San Francisco, you go into a community and you see the sign in, you know, Chinese as well as English, or you see the sign in Spanish as well as English. You know, you see that sort of thing happening where and we're getting a little bit of, I mean, that's like it's sort of teasing, it seems like, right now. In Southeast, you know, that we're getting to that point where we might be able to see, like, oh, this river's, here's the English name, but then here's the, you know, here's the Tlingit name, you know?
Yeah, and so Yetsin has a new album out, and I encourage folks to get it, listen to it, check it out. And he's also an artist, Nicholas Galanin, and he has a photograph of a sign that's in Sitka. And in really big letters, you have No Name Creek. And then in little tiny letters, you have the Tlingit name of the creek, which is Wakshachehuhin. And so what we're trying to do is say, okay, we're starting to get there. Mm-hmm. But how do we get to this place of decolonizing a landscape, which is very tricky? I know that some people will be triggered by that word and they don't like it. But what we're sort of trying to do is say there's something that was here before and we need to be able to see it and hear it and let it exist. And so when we look at place names and bringing place names back and the way that we put up signage, we don't want to be the also known as category. Like we want to be, this is what this thing was called for over 10,000 years. So it's okay if we just call it that. And then for some of them, what we've been pushing, those of us who are advocating for languages coming back in a strong way, is saying, well, some of this stuff is really a spelling and pronunciation adjustment. So some people would say Skagway, but you could also say Shkakwe. And some people say Klakwan, and you could also say Tlakwan. And so some of these are very close because they come from Tlingit words. And so we want folks to be able to pronounce them and to not feel afraid or embarrassed or like someone's going to make fun of you. And one of the things that I'm also hoping we get towards is to just lessen the sort of racist response that we get sometimes to trying to bring names back and to restore a lot of our indigenous place names. For some reason, people get really upset by this as if we weren't sitting here the whole time and just not being listened to. And so, but I think if you look at the overall majority of the population, I think a lot of people are just fine with this, but it's just something that has become foreign to the people who live here. And we want to examine that as well and say, well, when does Indigenous become foreign? Because I had someone who came to my house to help me with a plumbing issue. And he says, I called your number, but there's just some foreign language on there, so I didn't leave a message. And I said, well, it was Tlingit, which is as local as it gets. And he said, well, it's foreign to me. And so, but that's where I want to engage on this thing to say, like, you don't have to be outside of this. This language is so fun. It's so beautiful. Haida is so fun and beautiful. Tsimshian is so fun and beautiful. And you don't have to live here and know nothing about it. Like, you can engage and learn. And we see children, when we teach children the language, they're not sitting there thinking, well, I'm not Tlingit, I shouldn't speak it. They're just engaging in the language, and they're just going for it, and they're not afraid. And we're trying to sort of create that sort of energy community-wide so that people will use the language, and they'll feel like it's okay, and they're contributing to something which is going in a different direction than trying to just eliminate an entire group of people from where they were from.
Yeah. So this education opportunity, obviously people can register for the classes, they can audit them, the language classes. You can start with Tlingit 1 and move your way up or just take that one, whatever it might be. And those are offered for no charge for members of the community. You can also investigate, you know, the programs that we've been talking about, the certificates or the BLA in Tlingit language or, you know, whatever it is that you might be interested in. And then this program, this new one, which is sounds like it's not 100 yet, like it's close.
Yep.
You still have to get voted on. And this is a MA, Master of Arts in Teaching Indigenous Language. So this is for people who would be teaching in like K through 12, right? Which I think is fascinating because it feels like it's a generational thing. Like the more we pass on to, you know, the younger folks, then that becomes sort of a norm for them mixing, you know, and knowing both languages. They could know English and Tlingit or English and Nodkil, or they could, you know, whatever it is. And so this degree is for those people who want to invest in that future. And how do they have to have, what would be the requirements for somebody wanting to get into that MA program?
So you would have to have a bachelor's degree. So it is a graduate degree. And so you'd have to have a bachelor's degree, and then there's an application process, and there's some things you'd have to get ready to become a teacher. And this is where our Indigenous Studies program is in these ongoing conversations with the state of Alaska, because sometimes to become a teacher, you have to take an exam just to see what is your general knowledge. But typically some of these exams, they should always be investigated, and we should always look at them and say, well, what kind of knowledge is this testing? And is this a gateway to someone becoming a teacher? If you have someone who can speak the language really well, and we know they're going to be a great teacher, and if we're testing them to see, like, would they become a good teacher of a different subject matter, sometimes we're sort of making it harder than it needs to be. So we're in these constant conversations, and we're also in these conversations about fluency levels and teaching, because we want to say, well, you should know the language before you start teaching the language. However, there are some languages in Alaska where there's two speakers left, one speaker left, no speakers left, so we don't want to close the door on anybody. This degree would be for anybody who wants to teach an Indigenous language, whether that's Dene'ina, whether it's Inupiaq, whether it's Tlingit. And so we'll have lots of people together, because I think this is a precursor to more changes both in the state of Alaska and nationwide in terms of how do we develop and run Indigenous language schools. There are not enough of them. So we should probably say, okay, how many boarding schools were there in the United States? We need to make sure there's that many language medium schools in the United States. And then we sort of go from there. And when we say language medium, that means it's the language you teach through. You're not teaching the language to kids. You're teaching them about the rock cycle and the salmon cycle, and you're teaching them math and you're teaching them history all through your language, which is a huge, huge shift and sometimes might seem impossible. But if you go one grade at a time and you really commit to building it, and we are fully networked with other indigenous language schools, whether we're talking about the Yupik school in Bethel, the Yupik school in Anchorage, the Hawaiian schools, the Ojibwe schools, like we are linked in with them. And we're talking to them about what they did and how did it work. And then we want to talk to everybody who's interested in doing this in Alaska and say, would you like to start a language nest, which is a preschool where the language is your indigenous language? Or would you like to start a language medium school or a dual language school, which means you spend part of your time in the indigenous language and part of your time in English? And one of the things that is our mission is to make it all seem possible and then to eventually make it all seem inevitable.
Right.
So that's you're trying to build these things up. But one of the things that we're sort of looking to the state of Alaska for and leaders in education and leaders in our indigenous organizations and our partners who live here is there should be a school board that specifically focuses on the development of language nests and language medium schools and dual language schools, because it's very hard to start them. I don't think the current structure of education in Alaska or nationwide is built to accommodate that. We're going to compete with every existing school, and we're going to have to go ask them for some of their money, and these schools are struggling. Schools are struggling. Education systems are struggling. So for us to be so small and so pushed out to the margins already and to try and come and ask them to help us, if you have just the right situation, you'll get it. But what we're looking for is more of a statewide and national effort to say we are going to find ways to make this happen.
Well, it seems like, you know, in some of the materials you share with me, which aren't necessarily public yet, but there was something that struck me, which is what you're talking about here in essence, this the approach to the program. And you have there's a graph that has individual language and community, and it's called language, community, individual health, and they're sort of all interlinked. And I feel like that's sort of what you're getting at here. It's like all those things together are combined to make, you know, a community or a place whole.
Yeah, and we've been looking at a lot of research, and the research clearly shows a couple of things. One is if a child is learning multiple languages at the same time, it doesn't slow them down. It actually, they test higher, they do just fine. The second thing is that when a language is able to regain its high fluency levels among the people, for indigenous languages, you have reductions in things like diabetes and suicide rates, and you have increases in positive mental health. And so what we see this as is a community and regional health issue as well. And so one of the things that we look at in some of our coursework is trying to have a holistic approach to this. Yes, you can build a school and you can teach these kids the language, but now you need to build an adult immersion program so that when they come home, their families can engage with them. Because it's also going to open up a lot of wounds that people have. We have people today who were beaten as children because they spoke one of their indigenous languages. And that has a lasting and terrible effect. And it wasn't just a little bit here, a little bit there. It was pretty widespread. And also, we have elders who told us they used to walk down the street in this community of Juneau, and if they spoke their language, like, other kids would spit on them or yell at them or throw rocks at them. And so we're trying to sort of say that, okay, that might not be happening today, but that has a lasting impact on a person. This level of physical and emotional and spiritual and mental abuse that happened, we have to acknowledge that. We have to help people recover from that all around. Because I think one thing that the dehumanizing and inhumane nature of colonization creates wounds within everybody. And I think restoring indigenous languages helps those wounds all over the place, because we can have very upfront conversations about those types of things. And then we can just look at this little kid, sing a song, tell a story, speak a language. And as Larry Kimura would say, who is a, we call him the godfather of the Hawaiian language movement, he would say, let the children be the yeast. Because it's someone's going to say, this language is so hard, but then they see this little baby talking and they'll say, I want to go talk to that baby.
Yeah, absolutely. So people should be on the lookout for information. Is the best place to follow this the UAS website, like to look for, you know, press releases or announcements on the Alaska Native Languages Program page?
Yeah. So this is a collaborative effort between the UAS School of Arts and Sciences and the UAS School of Education. And so it's a joint degree. It houses in both of those programs. And as we get closer to presenting this to the Board of Regents, which if you know a regent or if you want to call into a Board of Regents meeting and say, we love this idea, we're accepting letters of support. We always feel like we're trying to do the impossible here. But I believe all these things are possible. But they're only possible when you fully manifest them and you really know what you're doing and you talk to other people who've done it. So if you're out there and you're interested in being an Indigenous language teacher, if you have a language that has maybe not enough speakers right now, we want to be there for you. We want to work in partnership with you. We anticipate this degree program. The classes are there. So we can teach these classes. And some of these classes are going to talk about what is language revitalization, what are the terms that we use, how do you teach Indigenous languages, how do you develop materials, and what are the foundational elements of Indigenous language schools? Yeah. Because just to sort of say it, like what if there was a school that taught entirely in Hatkil and Haida right now? What would that look like? And so one of the things is to just assure people that you don't have to do it tomorrow. You don't have to open a K-12 school next year, but maybe you open a language nest. But then the key is, like, you have this preschool, is at some point you have to build a kindergarten.
Right.
And what you should do, you know, and I got to be careful how I say should, but one idea would be we build a kindergarten this year, we build the first grade next year, and you just keep going. Because in some of them, like, it's not going to get easier. But it's going to be a lot easier than losing your language.
Absolutely. And the easiest way to get to the webpage is to just put into your favorite search engine, Alaska Native Language Program, UAS, and that'll probably lead you right to the pages that you need to get to. You can also visit a fantastic site that Hune runs, which is thlinkitlanguage.com. There's all kinds of free resources on that website. Lots of information. There's videos of Zoom classes that have been taught, so you can start at the beginning. There's links to dictionaries. There's links to all kinds of resources on thlinkitlanguage.com. You can check that page out. Before I have to let you go, Dr. Twitchell, Emmy Award-winning Dr. Twitchell, is there anything else? I know you're on sabbatical right now, but is there anything else that people should be thinking about from the university perspective here?
Yeah, I think a couple of things is the free options for the classes is possible because of a partnership with Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. But I think one of the things that we continually run into is this kind of mentality that you guys could do whatever you want as long as you pay for it yourselves. And so we really want to see more federal and state funding towards Indigenous languages. We want to see the Presbyterian Church has started stepping up and making public apologies for operating boarding schools and being part of the suppression of these languages. But right after COVID and then right after we made these classes free, we saw a big spike in enrollment and it's kind of dropped way back down. So the other thing is we want people to understand that it's the people who create the life of the language. And if you live with this language, it will change your life in ways that are just wonderful. And you will change the lives of other people. But we need to show up, and we need people to go there.
That was loud. Sorry about that.
I was going to get some amazing theme music. It was okay.
I was like, I didn't know there was some plan there. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
What were you saying?
So we just want to encourage people to, if you've ever been thinking of, like, part of my work is to cut the butt. And what I mean by that is I hear people say, I would love to, but, and just stop there and just say, I would love to. And then we'll meet you halfway. We'll start there. It's a safe thing to learn languages. We love each other. We take care of each other. We all learn in a collaborative way. And I think if you just really try and commit to it, because it's not easy to learn indigenous languages, but it is possible. We've seen it happen. We know there's multiple pathways to get there. And we just encourage everybody to get in the canoe. We got places to go.
There's space for everyone. Well, Gunnath Cheesh, for being here today. I really appreciate it. I could talk to you forever, of course, about all this. But look for it. It's the Master of Arts in Teaching Indigenous Language, a program that will hopefully be coming to UAS this fall. And also just go take a class, like get involved. Yeah, absolutely. Gunnath Cheesh. Thank you so much. We'll go out with a little more of a Yahtzeen, regular this time. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Emil Mackey at Country Financial, offering insurance for home, auto, and business, and life insurance to protect your family in case of death, located in the Juno Nugget Mall. More information can be found online or by calling 907-500-7017. This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. Revolution, rebellion, uprising, and also comedy? It's all part of the new production, Pueblo Revolt, opening February 27th at Perseverance Theater. The playwright, Dylan Christopher Chitto, recently said in an interview, the play questions, what do you do when history is happening around you? The play, which is set during the Pueblo Revolt of 1680, runs through March 15th on the Perseverance main stage in Douglas. And I'm pleased to welcome some of the team here to talk more about this play. The play has two characters, and both actors are here today. We welcome in Anthony Anaya Gorman, actor who's playing the role of Bahoma.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much for having me.
Gwyneth Cheesh, welcome in. Thank you so much. We also have Kenny Ramos, who is playing Feme Wim. Gwyneth Cheesh, wasiti. Kenny, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Excellent.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. And then we also have the director of the production, Daniel Lehman Smith. Gwyneth Cheesh, wasiti. How are you, Daniel?
Gwyneth Cheesh, doing great. Thanks so much for having us.
It's a pleasure. And then, of course, we also have Artistic Director for Perseverance, Leslie Ishii, who will share more details in a little bit on a collaboration with Theater in the Rough happening opening weekend called Weekend of Revolution. But we'll talk about that in just a little bit. Gwyneth Cheesh, Leslie.
Gwyneth Cheesh for having us. Glad to be here, as always.
Yeah. Okay, so let's start with you, Daniel. What was the Pueblo Revolt? Give us the background of what that Pueblo Revolt of 1680 was.
Yeah, so this is, you know, this historical event in which the Pueblo rose up against the Spanish occupying Santa Fe in New Mexico, and they drove them out, right? And so that's the short version of it. It's one of the first revolutions on this continent, right? Mm. And the first instance of indigenous folks fighting back.
And so what's the story of the play then?
So this is the story of two brothers who are, you know, coming together and fighting back against, you know, colonization, but really also trying to remember what life was like before colonization in a time in which they have no idea what that was, because they've been colonized their whole lives. And so it's really about that. It's about how do we remember who we were before when we have no knowledge of it ourselves, and also, you know, what do we do after?
And so let's talk about these brothers a little bit. Tell me a little bit about Feme Wim, Kenny, and how what's the story behind this guy?
Feme. How do I talk about Feme? Feme is the younger brother of the two. They're queer, they're idealistic, and I think they kind of have a sense of peace that they, I think, kind of maintain. In the end, I think really the brothers have different points of view on, like, what's happening, on how to move forward. I think Feme's point of view is, like, what's the way to move forward in which people don't have to die, or a way in which we can kind of be together. I think in the end, they really are quite innocent. And, yeah, they're kind of fun to lean into it, that kind of innocence of them. But, yeah, I think they're kind of a pacifist.
Okay. And, Anthony, tell me a little bit about Bahoma.
Yeah, Bahoma, I think, like Kenny said, you know, definitely the opposite. You know, for me, this is an opportunity for us to go back to the way that it was before. In other words, we have to completely clear the slate, not have any of the influence for us, and we're still at a point in which we can go back, is how I see it, you know. And in some ways, having to use tactics that they use, you know, for instance, you know, we might have to use violence right now to kind of push them out, but it's all necessary, essentially. And so I do think Bahoma has a lot of great intentions. He sees a future that he just really loves and adores so much. But then when he's talking to his brother, sometimes it's like, how do you not get this as well? And so, like you said, I think we both have the same end goal, but the methods to get there look drastically different. And that's where, like, the conflict comes in, essentially.
Yeah, and hence the conflict, right, and the drama. So what's the construct of this play, Daniel, in terms of how is it structured? I know there's some poetry in there. I know there's some other kind of stylistic choices. But then also, like in the preview, I said there's comedy in there. So tell me a little bit about the construct of the play.
Yeah, so the play, you know, it's very much an indigenous futurist piece. Yeah, it's set in, you know, 1680, but the language is very modern. You know, the characters speak like we speak today. And and Dylan does this wonderful job of playing with time, right, of using elements of now through sort of historicization, right, and what that speaks to. And it makes it this piece that's really, really alive and really salient to the moment that we're living in now. Like even just 2 weeks before arriving in Juneau, I was like, my God, this piece could not be more relevant. And so, you know, we're leaning into that in terms of the construct. I don't want to give too much away, but
secrets.
our fabulous scenic designer has sort of placed us in this world that's set inside of a sandbox. We're doing a lot with projections. And a lot of the visual design is going to evoke childhood, right? And this concept of a loss of innocence. And what is that? What does that mean in the context of colonialism? How does colonialism rob our innocence or our essence or who we are as people? But then also just that vocabulary of a sandbox and primary colors and kid-sized things. Like there's comedy, physical comedy that can be utilized in that in the camp of like, you know, big people, little chairs, those kinds of things.
Right.
And so there's a wonderful visual vocabulary that's there. But then, you know, comedy and joy are acts of radical resistance. And that's very much a part of Dylan's writing. And so it's wonderful to use that. This play is absolutely funny until it's not.
Right. Okay. And it is interesting, that question that Dylan had said in that interview that I looked at, what do you do when history is happening around you? And Leslie, can you hop in there on the mic real quick? For choosing this play as part of the season, is that one of the reasons you chose it? Is the sort of the outlook of using history to look at today? Or what was it that spoke to you about the play?
Yeah, absolutely. We were approached by other theaters to maybe do co-productions, or how can we help each other to make sure this play gets produced. And so it stayed on our list and eventually felt like, oh, this is timely. We kind of have a knack for that, I think. And also there's a mention of gold, you know, here our history in gold. And then as it worked out, I, in my own history, have had artistic time in New Mexico, so Nuevo Mexico. So that kind of appealed to me. And then just connecting the dots, like we had a wonderful meeting and introduction of our team here with Dr. Rosita, and just noticing all the connections with maybe Alaska Natives and Navajo and folks in the various regions in the lower 48 too, and historically how that works. But one of the other major points was, how do we look at colonization as we've had our own, you know, commitment humbly to decolonizing, what that's meant in our newest chapter now as we get on to the into this chapter. And then how do we look at that and then prepare for a couple centuries later, the Tlingit opera, the battles with Tlingit and the Russians in Sitka.
So right, you've been working on this Tlingit opera for a few years now. There's been a few public workshops here and there. Is there a plan for that being done soon?
Yes, that's going to be our season opener.
Oh, next
this coming
year.
Season.
Okay.
So we're really excited. So we kind of, this felt like a really beautiful, important setup historically as we move through time around colonization, different battles with indigenous and outside forces. And then I'll just share too, if I can, in April, look for the concert, the spring concert with the Juneau Symphony. We'll be partnering with them, with Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, to bring an excerpt of the opera to their spring concert.
So excellent.
And how beautiful.
A little preview.
Ed Littlefield will be listed with Aaron Copland and other well-known composers, as he should be. So we're just very excited to introduce, give you a little teaser this spring.
Absolutely. That's so cool.
Thank you.
So let's also get to know you all a little bit. Kenny Ramos, you've been to Juneau numerous times. You've been in various different productions at Perseverance Theater. I think people saw you in, last was, I think, Where the Summit Meets the Stars. And then before that was probably
Devilfish?
The Vera Starbird play that was right before the pandemic.
Yeah. Yep.
That was the last play before the pandemic, I think.
Yeah.
Pretty close anyway. And so what keeps bringing you back to Alaska?
Oh, my gosh. I love it here. I just love it here. So many things. I mean, like the people, the community, the landscape, the water. But I've really enjoyed all the kind of work I've done with Perseverance. I've been really lucky, I think, to be a part of like Alaska Native Theater, but also just like really Tlingit-centric theater. Mm. Between Devilfish, Summit Meets the Stars. I also did a Tlingit Christmas Carol, which was online.
Mm.
And then I've been lucky to be a part of some workshops of the Tlingit Opera. But I think there's just some really exciting like ways in which Tlingit theater is like pushing the boundaries of American theater, of live theatrical storytelling. And that was evident with my first project here in Devilfish. Like, I just can't get enough of working with Vera, with Frank, with Ed. It's just, and of course, Leslie. And of course, shout out to Erin, my like bestie. And I love working with her, Erin Tripp. But it's really like all those things, like the art, but also the people. And I love making art with the people here and for the people here.
And you are based in Southern California, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm on the Brona Indian Reservation, which is in San Diego County. So okay. Very different climate.
Very different climate.
And it's snowing. It's crazy.
And you've worked with there was a big theater down there that does a lot of community-based work, mm-hmm. Cornerstone.
Yes.
And that's I don't want to say inherent or it's sort of part of your work, right, is to be telling Indigenous stories.
Yeah, I'm really passionate about Native theater, Native storytelling, the way theater connects to sovereignty, really, or the way it can be an assertion of our sovereignty, the way theater is used to pass down stories, culture, history. With Cornerstone, I do a lot of community-centered or community-engaged theater. So we make plays with and about different communities, and we've been able to do that work with like urban Native communities in Los Angeles, urban and reservation-based in Phoenix and Tempe area, but also our most recent project was a statewide tour that was in partnership with Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota tribal communities. And we toured a queer Lakota superhero play all across the plains, mostly reservation communities in North and South Dakota, but also, you know, the cities as well. The cities, Rapid City, Sioux Falls. But I'm just really passionate about how theater can be in service to community and how it can, help perpetuate our beings, ourselves, our stories.
That's cool. And you're listening to Juno Afternoon. We're talking with the team from Perseverance Theater about their new production, Pueblo Revolt, which opens next Friday, February 27th. It runs through March 15th. You can go to ptalaska.org for information on the play and get yourself a ticket. And Anthony, you in your bio, I noticed that it said this is your first regional theater. This is your debut.
It is. Yes.
So tell me a little bit about your journey to becoming an actor. How did you get here?
I'm trying to figure out the short story for that answer. I've been performing since I was a kid. My family had a Navajo dance team, and so we danced throughout the Southwest. And my grandfather was a code talker during World War II, and one of his friends, Dean Wilson, who was also a code talker and part of that first group, he was my dance teacher. He was my mom's, and so I just grew up around a lot of that, in Casa Grande, the intertribal Indian ceremonial. It's how my mom met my dad, so kind of all of that. I did typical high school plays and everything, found myself just really enjoying it. College, I took the classes, acting 101, 102 and everything. Mm. And then I traveled with the international tour group Up With People.
Actually. Oh, yeah, I've heard of that.
So I did that for 6 months as a student and did the frontline dances. And then I got hired to be their lighting tech. And so I kind of did the behind-the-scenes stuff. But I did that for 3 years. We did a lot of community service work. But we also believe very much that music is a common language for everybody to come around. And so I traveled with them to 12 countries.
Wow.
And all of that. And then basically I went back home and I still kind of did acting, community theater, college, short films, all that kind of stuff. And then I ended up going to grad school in something entirely different. And so I pursued international development. However, to Kenny's point, I really focused a lot on community arts and development. So I remember working with a nonprofit, Nina Shingu, in Ecuador, where we did a lot of programming around arts and identity, letting people find ways to create their art and all of that. And so that was really beautiful. So art's always kind of been with me, whatever it might be. But getting back into acting when I came out of grad school or during grad school, I was like, I think I miss acting. I think I miss the stage. I found all my downtime was really looking at arts. I wrote a paper at one point because I was just so done writing academic papers. So I actually compared Tarzan the musical to narrative identity. And my teacher was like, this was different but fun, but you hit the point. So anyways, I started to look at it and I ended up moving to New York shortly after grad school and went to an acting school that I've been staring at for 5 years. And that is the Esper Studio. Loved it. I did 2 years of Meisner training there, and then I got hired to work in the office, and so I'm very privileged to be around a lot of great teachers and everyone. And then through all that process, I was like, you know, I'm kind of getting caught into teaching and some other stuff. I'm still doing short films, and so Daniel, I met him because of a friend who came from New Mexico. I was like, I want you to meet other native artists here, and I was like, great, because New York, it's big, a lot of people around, but sometimes it feels very, very disconnected. So because of that connection, and I met Daniel 3 times, I think, and all of a sudden I was like, I guess I'm going to Alaska.
There you go.
And so it all came together and it was great. I'm super excited. Perseverance has been fantastic. So just really to just, yeah, work on my first regional theater and to also work here at Perseverance. It's just a double debut that I'm really excited
for. And
then
your first time to Juno as well.
It is my first time to Juno. I've only been to Anchorage once about 8 years ago or so. I did have a job offer in Juno after grad school, but again, life took me somewhere else. But yeah, I was like, oh, like I feel like life keeps bringing me like Juno kept coming up. So to finally actually come and show up and be here has been great.
That's awesome. And Daniel, what was you're also new to Perseverance.
Yeah.
This is your first directing gig here at Perseverance, but you're a director back in New York City?
Yeah. So I live in New York City. I'm originally from Oklahoma, but I've been in New York for 7 years now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about your approach as a director.
So I really come at it from a world-building sort of mindset and thinking about, you know, what is the overall message? What is the journey of an audience? And what are we seeing and feeling? What are we walking away thinking about? What are we feeling and experiencing throughout this piece? And so it's visual. A lot of times I start externally and build from the outside in. And so I think it's different from a lot. And then I tend to be a little bit musical in the way that I listen and then start to craft a scene with people, which drives people crazy sometimes because it's, I will stop and start people a ton.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And then what was your in for this play, Pueblo Revolt? What was it that sort of made you say, yes, I want to direct that play?
So I teach a course called Approaching Indigenous Theater at both the NYU Tisch School of the Arts and at Marymount Manhattan College. And I found this play around the time that I first met Dylan Chitto in like 2022, I think, which is around when I started teaching the class also. And so I had met a lot of people through the Yale Indigenous Performing Arts Program, where I've spent 4 seasons working alongside Maddie Sayet and a number of other folks. And so I incorporated it into my curriculum around comedy and joy as acts of radical resistance within contemporary Native theater. And Dylan and I have over the years just gotten to be really good friends. So I've also been a dramaturg for him on a number of other plays that he's creating. And so coming specifically to this, when Perseverance announced the season, I was out in Los Angeles working on Dylan's latest play. Kenny was there also.
Yeah.
And so Dylan and I sort of schemed coming to Juno.
I got you. Yeah. Okay. Well, welcome. Is this your first time in Alaska?
Very first time.
Wow. Well, welcome in. Kenneth Cheesh. And then, Leslie, let's wrap it up with you here in terms of Weekend of Revolution. So this play, Pueblo Revolt, is opening next week, but you're collaborating with Theater in the Rough to do a whole weekend of activity. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Exactly, sure. We're thrilled to be partnering with Theater in the Rough. Weekend of Revolution, as you mentioned, we opened the 27th. And we just sensed that our communities want to have a voice, and there's so much uprising right now. How do we express ourselves and be a part of what we hope will be uplifting our humanity and, of course, move toward our collective freedoms and liberation? So, like I said, 27th of February, next week, here we go. We open. They'll come and table. You can be a part of this partnership. And then Saturday, that'll be Friday, then Saturday, they will have the 10 Steps to Personal Revolution Cabaret, so folks can participate, sing, bring that, their own personal revolution kind of poetry, song, all the things. And then the very next day, and, you know, our show will keep running through that weekend and into the next two weekends, but then Sunday of that opening weekend, they will do a new adaptation of Antigone. Antigone, We Are the Rebels Asking for the Storm.
Ooh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. You know how Antigone speaks truth to power, right?
Yeah, so, for sure.
Just so thrilled that we're able to provide this for the community as we all come together around what's happening in these times that are challenging, but having a voice is important. And this is also what I love. All proceeds will go to NAMI.
Oh, that's great.
Here in Juneau. So
excellent.
We just want to support the community as well.
Yeah, and Theater in the Rough will be here next Wednesday to talk a little bit more about their productions that they're doing that weekend.
Yes.
So this is Pueblo Revolt. It opens at Perseverance Theater on Friday, February 27th. It runs through March 15th. I do want to mention that there are some pay-as-you-can opportunities so that it's accessible theater for all. And those are on Saturday, the 28th at 7:30 p.m. That's a pay-as-you-can. And then also Thursday, the 5th of March, there'll be a pay-as-you-can. And if you really want to see the play early, next Wednesday, mm-hmm. I think even before opening, on February 25th, there will be a little pay-as-you-can preview. Right, Leslie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'll share, too, that we are implementing new rates for students.
Oh, excellent.
We're looking at a student matinee. But if students want to come with their friends, we're really working to make that affordable, really really almost like a pay what you can as well.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's so great. Mm-hmm. We can go to ptalaska.org for more information on the play and all of these folks. You can follow Perseverance Facebook page. They have bios for all the folks up there. They even have this really cool little image of, you know, talking about the play a little bit, and also bios of these wonderful actors and this wonderful director. You can find out a little bit more about them. And is there any talkbacks for this play scheduled or anything?
Yes. Actually, Saturday the 28th is our UAS night.
Oh, okay.
University of Alaska Southeast, and please come. We'll also be setting up more, so please, you know, stay
follow
in touch.
The Facebook, right?
That's right.
Yeah,
yep.
Or your Instagram, all that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Everything. Follow the socials, and I'm
yes.
sure you can find all these actors and directors on the socials as well. I really appreciate y'all being here. Gonna cheese break a leg.
Thank you. Gonna
cheese. Thank you for having us. We love it.
That will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. We air Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Akbe 91.7. Hello, out the road. You can find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. You can also find live stream archives on KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you, plus Country Financial, Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Tongass Federal Credit Union. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gonna the cheese!